Welcome to Inflammation Nation. My name is Brian Lynch. Inflammation Nation is a podcast from Arthritis Ireland aimed at increasing awareness and understanding of arthritis and related conditions. I'm delighted to be joined today by Iris Inc. Iris is a rheumatology nurse practitioner in Michigan and past president of the Rheumatology Nurses Society. And Iris is the author of a new book called Sex Interrupted, which is about intimacy and sexual health while living with chronic illness and disability. Iris, thanks a million for joining us today. Delighted to have you as our guest.
Thank you.
I wonder if we can start off with one of the big questions in terms of how arthritis affects sexual health and well-being.
It's a huge problem. So the whole reason that I wrote the book was about 15 years ago, I had a patient who had ankylosing spondylitis, which is one of the spondyloarthritises that we treat. And when I thought I was done evaluating her and walking towards the door, she said, "Oh, I have one more question." And I said, "What's that?" And she said, "I can't open my legs wide enough to have sex with my partner." And I looked at her like a stupid dog. I turned my head. And she said, "Oh my gosh, I've embarrassed you." And I said, "You haven't embarrassed me. I just don't know the answer."
Yeah.
So that kind of prompted this whole research and starting this lecture and really reaching out to what was out there. I called my local librarian and she was only able to find about 20 articles at that point in time about arthritis and intimacy. But she found 600 articles on how intimacy was affected by any kind of healthcare issue, including sleep apnea and blindness and, you know, mastectomy and prostatectomy and all kinds of things. So I took all 600 articles and that's how the kind of book evolved. So certainly with arthritis, there's a lot of pain, there's a lot of fatigue associated, and there can be problems with mobility. But I figured out that my patients are pretty tricky about figuring out their positions. It wasn't the positions that was holding them back. It was really the communication that was holding them back.
And why do you think that is? I mean, given how important sexual health is to our well-being, you know, the WHO underlines it as they describe it as being fundamental to overall health and well-being of individuals. So why then are we, if you like, so bad or not more comfortable with talking about this?
I don't know that we're taught how to communicate properly with a partner. I think, you know, we're taught how to read and write and arithmetic and balance our checkbook, but they were never really taught about communication and how to really actively communicate with our intimate partner. So I think that's the huge problem, is that I have patients who tell me that they're so shy that they don't even know how to bring up the topic of sex, and yet they've had children. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's really something that is still very taboo in a lot of cultures. And certainly in religions, there are still this just, it's dirty, it's only for procreation kind of mentality, which is crazy, because without some level of bonding and intimacy, we know that infants never survived. And we know that the elderly don't do well. And so we all need that intimacy level, whatever that means to you at any age.
Mm-hmm. There was a small Irish study conducted a couple of years ago in 2018, which looked at patients' perceptions of the effects of arthritis on their sexual relationships and sexual activity. Now, the study itself was small. There wasn't big numbers participated, but I might just, because I suppose it's largely an Irish audience possibly might be listening to this, but just to see, kind of to report some of the findings from it. So roughly a little over a quarter of the participants reported that arthritis had put a strain on the relationship, right? Half of them said that it altered their sexual relationship. And they highlighted fatigue and reduced libidos as contributing factors to all of that. Again, half of them reported pain, mobility and disinterest limiting sexual intercourse. But funnily enough, over three quarters said that their sexual ability was very important or important to them. So it's almost like there's a disconnect there between its importance in their life and yet the challenges that arthritis is raising. And I suppose the critical thing, and this picks up on what you were saying there, is that many of the participants did not discuss the impacts of the arthritis on their sexual relationships with their partners. And they also were concerned as well that their partners didn't really understand what was going on. So I wonder then, let's pick up on that theme in terms of communication between partners in a relationship. How do you get the conversation going?
I love it when couples come in together. That really helps. But I hear so many times from someone in my office that they say, you know, "I don't think my spouse really understands how much pain I'm in." You know, and then what I hear from the spouse a lot of times is, you know, it's devastating to me that my wife got diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis or psoriatic arthritis or, you know, some type of this arthritis, and I don't want to cause her any more pain or more fatigue, so I just stopped touching her. Mm-hmm. Well, then, of course, then the partner feels like they're no longer attractive. You know, the role shift happens where perhaps the female partner in the relationship or one partner in the relationship was doing a predominance of the cooking and cleaning and household duties. And then suddenly there's this new autoimmune disease that shows up, and then that throws off the balance. Mm. And, you know, it's just, it's this whole trying to figure out where you're at with things and how to move forward from there. And really going through the stages of grief of my life. I thought my life was going to go this direction, and now it's not going to go this direction. And I see so many of my patients, people that I am lucky enough to take care of, push their spouse away because they think, oh, I'm just going to be a burden to that person. So, you know, maybe they'd be better off without me. So there's this whole crazy thing that happens when you're diagnosed with a chronic illness. Mm.
And do you reckon then are people kind of reluctant to ask for help, or just that they don't even know who to turn to help?
I think that's both. I think that, you know, in America, there's not, mental health is very difficult to access in some respects, in that the insurance doesn't oftentimes pay for it. Oh, there's a lot. Thank goodness for coronavirus. One of the good things that happened with that is that telemedicine became so much more accessible. So now, you know, there's a lot more online resources for people for counseling. Although I hear the marital counselors are booked up for 18 months because people have been home alone together a little bit too long. But, you know, there, so I think that has been a good shift. But then there's also, you know, in a lot of religious organizations, there's not someone that people feel comfortable talking to about intimacy and relationships. Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering then, does this raise the point in terms of, you know, someone maybe living with inflammatory arthritis, say, for example, you know, they have a very important relationship with the rheumatology team, with their consultant, potentially with a rheumatology nurse, someone like yourself, with an OT, with a physio. So how do they kind of get to raise those conversations there? Because again, we oftentimes hear, you know, that the doctors themselves oftentimes may not bring up or may not start these conversations. So mm-hmm. it really comes back on the patient, if you like. How would you advise someone? What would you say to someone about doing that and its importance?
I think they just have to keep trying. First of all, they have to have a relationship with whoever their healthcare provider is, that is a trusting relationship, something that they have established, hopefully. And then also, you know, I have other issues. I'm concerned about how this is affecting my intimacy is a perfect way to bring this up. The problem is, and I understand this from a healthcare standpoint, is that we have to check all these boxes. We have to worry about your cholesterol being too high and whether the medications are hurting you and if your laboratory values are okay and all of these things that we have to do in the visit. And then, you know, the intimacy oftentimes just gets to be on the back burner. Even with gynecologists and urologists and, you know, after mammogram, this is just not a topic that's discussed, but it's so very important. So I would just advise people to keep bringing it up and bringing it up to anyone that'll talk to them, because it may not necessarily be your rheumatologist or your primary care provider. It's whoever will listen. Mm.
In many ways, it often strikes me that perhaps, you know, there can be nearly people being divided by a common language here. You know, kind of one side is concerned about DAS scores and inflammatory markers, and patients then are frequently coming with a different set of concerns, whether it is relationships or work, or their family connections, the ability to be able to pick up their kids, simple stuff. But sometimes either feeling that they give themselves permission to say that, or recognizing that, in fact, this is really important, and that unless you discuss it, well, then unfortunately, if you don't discuss it, there's not going to be any progress or addressing of the issues.
Absolutely. I truly believe that unless you're taking care of the patient's spiritual health and physical health and social health, that they're not going to get better, because if they can't afford their medications and they're exhausted because they're taking care of a sick loved one at home, I mean, you're never going to get to remission. So you have to treat the whole person holistically. Mm. And I think that is oftentimes missed by providers. Mm.
Yeah, that holistic point is really important, isn't it? We're very good possibly at treating individual conditions, you know, sequentially almost in many ways, but yet kind of considering how the person is in the round and all of those aspects of their life, that oftentimes that gets missed. What can we do about that as a society, or as, you know, healthcare providers or patient organizations? How can we kind of reinforce those values and beat that drum so that that becomes the norm, the holistic interpretation, the holistic treatment becomes the norm?
I think I was just reading about Ireland and intimacy before I got on the interview to be educated. And you've had a little billboard campaign, which I thought was really, really awesome. I don't know if that, how long ago that happened, where you have all these older couples that are doing very intimate things on the billboard, which I think is awesome. I think it's just about normalizing it. And luckily, on television, it's much more normalized. It's more normalized to have same-sex couples. It's much more normalized to expect that people are having intimacy. And so I think it's just, it's the same thing as talking about your bunion on your foot is talking about, you know, I'm also having problems with intimacy.
Go ahead, Iris. Yeah.
You brought up libido, which I think is a fascinating thing. In my office, we check every single patient's sex hormone, which is a DHEA, is a sex hormone that allows your body to produce other hormones. And I can't believe how low it is in so many of the patients that we see. And that's a nutritional thing, which I think is fascinating, too, because I'm just really fascinated by my teenage 20-year-old children, that they seem to be much less sexual beings. There's a lot of Netflix and chill, but they're not near as sexual, I think, as my husband and I were at that age. But I think that it could be diet. So I think that the even simple things like making sure that you're getting the right nutrition to help your libido, and making sure that you're taking care of yourself and you're being mindful and you're actually investing time in the intimacy. Because, you know, we spend so much time watching TV and cleaning the house and, you know, surfing on our phones, but are we really dividing time or devoting time to spend enhancing our relationship with our partner?
That sense of our people's sense of themselves, rather, as sexual beings, let's explore that a bit more, because I'm thinking, say, with regard to the impact of chronic pain or fatigue or fibro fog, or many of the other symptoms of arthritis, or indeed the effects of medication. You know, they can really dent a person's sense of themselves in lots of ways, and certainly as sexual beings. So how can they go about rediscovering that aspect of themselves?
That's a really good question. I love that. I think it's about not being really disappointed in your body. I think a lot of people, when they're first diagnosed with an autoimmune disease, there's two ways. There's, you know, I did something wrong. You know, I didn't pray hard enough. I didn't take care of myself well enough. I did something wrong that made this happen. And so then there's some self-loathing that goes on. Or, you know, that there's a denial. It's back to the stages of grief, you know, that this doesn't really happen and I'm going to take this supplement, it's going to go away. So it's getting past that, or this is, you know, this is my new normal. And it's not, I am not fibromyalgia. That is just something that I'm dealing with. You know, it's about not taking on the ownership of that it's not all of me, that I'm a separate person from that. And I'm going to have good days and I'm going to have bad days and I'm going to have more good days if I take care of myself. So it's just getting to that realization. And I think it really comes back to the mindfulness and the self-care and the connection with oneself through just feeling better and accepting that, yeah, this is something that I'm dealing with, but it's not something that I am.
And that's vital, isn't it? You know, that kind of how you feel about the disease relative to who you are. I'm intrigued in your book, you kind of say that, you know, whenever you give a lecture about sexual health, you ask the audience to identify the two biggest sex organs in the body, oftentimes at the start of the discussion or start of the lecture. Do you want to tell people what they are?
Yes, absolutely. So it's your brain and your skin are your two biggest sexual organs, because, you know, even in people who have no sexual functioning whatsoever, your brain can very much arouse you. So people who have no sense of, you know, they've lost the sense of sensation in their body because of quadriplegia or whatever that's happened to them, they can still very much orgasm because that's coming from the brain. And then certainly a majority of our revving up or sexual arousal comes from our skin. So without that skin-to-skin touch, then we're in big trouble. And whenever I talk about sex, I absolutely do not mean penetration, because that is just not an option for people as they age necessarily. It's really about holding hands and spooning and whatever intimacy means to you. It's just so important to maintain that intimacy. I've had so many people that tell me after my prostate surgery, I just stopped touching my partner. I'm thinking to myself, that is horrifying, because just because your dick doesn't work or your penis doesn't work doesn't mean that you shouldn't maintain intimacy with your spouse. And I say that very frankly. And then I say things like, and your tongue broke. I mean, you know, there are so many ways to show sexuality without a working penis, or if vaginal penetration is too painful, there's many, many other ways to have sexual interactions. Mm.
That kind of really calls on us then to kind of define sex much more broadly than just intercourse, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
And do you think, like, kind of, I suppose this is where people need to probably be imaginative, rediscover a sense of fun, of playfulness. And it's back to, I'm kind of struck, you know, when we were talking there a moment ago about body image and your sense of self. And, you know, for some people maybe who might have undergone surgery, they might have had, you know, joints replaced. They might, for example, kind of, you know, if they have psoriatic arthritis, they might also have psoriasis. So one sense of body image can be hugely challenged. And that kind of, it's so much of it is up in the head then, isn't it? You know, you kind of, mm-hmm. you don't find yourself appealing or attractive or, you know, sexually mm-hmm. exciting. And how do we let go of those perceptions? How do we let go of those hang-ups so that you're comfortable enough in yourself to be able to reach out to a partner, to another person?
Again, I think that requires a great deal of counseling, because patients with psoriatic arthritis in the United States, there was a study and more than half of them were clinically depressed. And I think it's because it's a very visible disease, you know, the psoriasis on the skin. And luckily now there's lovely medications. And you and I had the conversation the other day that you actually have access to medications in your country, which is fabulous. So it's about loving yourself enough to take care of yourself, getting the help that you need, and then also self-care. Without the diet and the exercise piece and the mindfulness, people just do not get better. And you have to love yourself enough to take care of yourself, but you also have to relate to your partner and say, you know, I need a half an hour to do yoga, and I need, because I'm going to be a better person, I'm going to feel better, and I'm going to be much more likely to want to have adult playtime with you later if I take care of myself now. So it's about that. But the whole depression because of how I look is very, very difficult. And I think that people really oftentimes need counseling.
Mm. Iris, do men and women experience these issues differently?
I think so, because I have known several men that have lost their job and their dog died and they still want to have sex. So I think, you know, men's reaction to stress is oftentimes doing something that is normal. And so sexuality is a great mind release for men, whereas for women, we have to have the recycling on the curb already before we're there. I mean, you know, women believe that we're multitaskers, we're horrible at it, but we believe that. And so we're trying to think about 15 things all the same time. And unless you can get into your nothing box, and I talk about the nothing box in the book, you're never going to get to orgasm. And, you know, if you're trying to watch Netflix and you've got a dog in the bed and the kids are, you know, banging on the door, it's really not going to happen. You're really going to have to devote some serious time to intimacy without TV on and unplugged.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I don't think there's ever been a greater focus and awareness around things like mindfulness and mindful practice and living mindfully, and even how COVID enabled us to do that, because we were kind mm-hmm. of less caught up in the rat race. But yet, you know, we kind of maybe haven't translated that fully into all the different aspects of our life. And I know you write about kind of being in the moment. And unless you're really in the moment with the other person, you know, you're fighting an uphill battle.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's the nothing box, which I think is really funny. There's a comedian that talks about your nothing box when your spouse says, honey, what are you thinking about? And you say nothing. And women go, whatever. We're thinking about 20 things all the time. How can you not be thinking about anything? But you really do have to get into that nothing box of, you know, I'm visualizing a white dry erase board. And then I'm thinking about how much I love my husband's touch or my wife's touch or my partner's touch, and the way they smell and the way this feels to be in this warm bed together. And, you know, you have to kind of keep thinking about all those sensations to bring yourself back to the moment so that you actually have an orgasm or a chance to have an orgasm. Mm-hmm.
I think I've been guilty a few times myself of saying I'm thinking about nothing when that's possibly the furthest thing from the truth, really. It becomes an easy answer to rely on, doesn't it? It might even stop. It probably stops further probing and questions, really. So it is an easy answer, isn't it?
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
We're going to take a short break from our conversation with Iris to turn to a regular look at popular beliefs and understandings about arthritis. This week, Peter Boyd is exploring what people feel about the use of supplements.
Thanks a million for that, Brian. Today, in our regular look at popular beliefs and understandings about arthritis, we're talking about supplements and arthritis. Those answering the Arthritis Ireland helpline are often asked, are there any specific diets, foodstuffs or supplements that should be added and removed from people's day-to-day diets? With a greater awareness of food allergies and intolerances, there's a larger proportion of the population wondering if what they consume could be influencing the pain and swelling they feel. This week, we asked Niamh Hogan to venture to County Meath, home of the great herbalist Sean Boylan, to see what the Royals made of food, supplements and their influence on arthritis.
I'm 77 now and I don't have arthritis. I was told by an aunt of mine when I was young to take cod liver oil and to prevent arthritis. So lucky enough, so far I don't have arthritis.
I've heard turmeric is good for arthritis.
I don't really know much about arthritis at all, but my mother always says to me that grapefruit was very bad to take when you had arthritis. Now I have sort of just small but not much arthritis, but she just always said to me, never take grapefruit.
Hi, I take calcium, magnesium and glucosamine for my joints.
Yeah, I've heard my granny say that fish oil helps for arthritis in their joints, so maybe that's something to think about.
My granddad has arthritis and my granny always makes him take super milk for the vitamin D in it, because she says that really helps with just the everyday maintaining arthritis.
I don't know a lot about arthritis, but I have heard people say that fish oils help with their joint pain and stuff, but that's all I know.
So there we have the views of the people of County Meath. I'm joined now by Rochelle Flanagan, dietitian extraordinaire. I hope she doesn't mind me describing her as that. We have a number of different views and different supplements that were mentioned there. Things like cod liver oil, turmeric, calcium, glucosamine. Is there any evidence or anything that we should be looking for as people living with arthritis to add to our diets as supplements?
Yeah, in terms of supplements, I suppose two that probably stand out the most in terms of the evidence would be vitamin D and then omega-3 supplements. So in terms of the vitamin D, from a sort of health point of view, a lot of people with arthritis suffer from osteopenia or osteoporosis, so brittle bones. So there's good reason to take vitamin D anyway. But there is some research showing, saying the likes of rheumatoid arthritis, that vitamin D may help to reduce the activity of the disease. Not so much maybe slowing the kind of progression of it, but certainly possibly the activity of it. And also in terms of osteoarthritis, there is some benefit in terms of taking vitamin D as well. So, from majority of people in Ireland are low in vitamin D anyway. So because we don't have the natural sort of sunshine. So people should be aiming to get between 10 and 15 micrograms of vitamin D a day anyway. What I would say is that I would, get your vitamin D levels checked to make sure that they are not, too low or too insufficient, because if they're very low, then you might need a higher dose amount for a number of months to kind of bring you up to normal. So there basically is, in terms of, different conditions like ankylosing spondylitis patients, that low vitamin D is associated with a higher disease activity as well. And if your levels are less than 30 nanomoles per liter, that's basically low in vitamin D. It's associated with rheumatoid arthritis occurrence and activity. So, there's a mixture there showing that there's benefit for checking your vitamin D levels and getting supplemented when you're deficient. You have to be careful not to take too high doses of vitamin D, because there can be toxicity there as well. So basically the message is, go to your GP, your consultant, get your vitamin D levels checked, and then supplement based on those levels. In terms of the omega-3, yes, there is some evidence, because omega-3 has a kind of an anti-inflammatory, and obviously with a lot of arthritic conditions, they can be inflammatory in nature. So taking things that help to reduce that inflammation is good, and omega-3 has a role to play there. However, the research is, it's mixed in terms of how much to take. I mean, there is some evidence to show that it is beneficial in reactive arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, ankylosing spondylitis, and fibromyalgia. And also in terms of or rheumatoid arthritis as well, it may actually lead to reduced pain and reduced usage of anti-inflammatories. So it's definitely worth, you know, discussing with your GP and your consultant about it. Generally speaking, the research shows kind of, you know, higher doses would be around 3 grams of EPA, DHA a day. But again, this is something that you need to talk to your consultant, I would say. I mean, in terms of omega-3, you can get a lot from your diet. So getting in an oily fish, you know, like trout, mackerel, salmon, once or twice a week will give you a good amount of your omega-3. In terms of high doses, you won't get it from just the fish alone. So that's where maybe supplements might come in. But I would talk to your consultant about before taking high dose supplements. There has been some research over the years that shows high dose amounts of omega-3 through supplements may be associated with more aggressive prostate cancers in men. So that's why it's always, you know, just to do it on an individual basis. What works for one person may actually be negative for another. So those would be kind of the two main ones that I would say. I think you mentioned there in terms of kind of, you know, things like turmeric and curcumin. And so there is some research to show, again, that these spices may have an anti-inflammatory effect. What I would say is, you know, use it in your cooking rather than taking high dose amounts because they can have negative impacts as well. So the research is not strong enough in terms of taking supplemental form as yet, but certainly taking it in your cooking is not a bad thing to do. I think, I suppose, obviously one of the key ones in terms of the osteoarthritis has been around chondroitin and glucosamine. And at the moment, there's no robust evidence to show that, you know, taking the over-counter versions really work. What I would say is it's not going to do any harm if you take them. So if you feel, you know, there's a placebo effect that it's doing you good. But in terms of evidence, there is stronger evidence for prescription level of chondroitin and glucosamine, but there's kind of conflicting advice from different guidelines about osteoarthritis. So really you need to discuss with your consultant whether that is something that they believe is worthwhile pursuing. So those are kind of the main things. You know, the research would show that the Mediterranean diet in particular would be beneficial for osteoarthritis. It's kind of, they're not seeing it so strongly in rheumatoid arthritis, but I think it's because the trials are kind of lacking in terms of numbers and quality. So the Mediterranean diet, generally speaking, has a sort of an anti-inflammatory effect because it contains, you know, higher level of omega-3 fatty fish. It contains monounsaturated fats through the likes of olive oil. It contains lots of fibrous foods through your fruit and vegetables and your whole grains. And all these things help to sort of reduce inflammation in the body. And obviously to choose less red meat in the diet, more plant-based proteins in the diet. And if you're going to choose meat, the sort of lean chickens, egg, you know, those kind of things. And not that you can't have red meat, but, you know, in Ireland, people tend to eat an awful lot of it every day. So reducing it down to, you know, sort of 9 ounces max in the week would be, you know, the amount of red meat. So really, you know, if people start off with getting the basics right, which is the diet right, that often has the first major impact. And I suppose in terms of for a lot of things like osteoarthritis, in particular, weight loss has shown to be one of the biggest predictors of reducing pain and disability through osteoarthritis. So losing 5 to 10 kilos has a huge benefit on pain management. So it's not, supplements are just plasters, if you ask me. You know, you got to get the basics right first, and then a dietitian will help you, you know, supplement in with the appropriate supplements on top of that.
Well, it's a really comprehensive answer. We really appreciate you giving us that background. And it is something that comes up very often. A lot of awareness now around allergies and food intolerances and different things like that. So it is something that's going to come back to, I'm sure, many more times in the future. For the moment, though, thanks a million for joining us on Inflammation Nation. Rochelle Flanagan, dietitian. It's now back to Brian Lynch, who's with Irish Sync, talking about relationships and sexual health.
Thanks a million, Peter, and welcome back to our conversation with Irish Sync. Let's continue our conversation, Iris. You mentioned there a moment ago about parenting and, you know, the challenges of life and all of that kind of stuff. And obviously, you know, it's well documented that as, you know, kids arrive and families grow into that in itself, they are pressures on normal sexual relationships within, you know, within families, within between a couple. When you bundle that with an arthritis diagnosis, people living with a chronic disease, the variability of symptoms, you know, unpredictability of flare-ups, that really is a very heady brew, isn't it, to try and kind of manage and to try and figure it back to you, kind of juggling all these balls again. But it's a huge load. How can people kind of come to terms with all of that?
I think you have to establish a date night. I think it's very, very important that couples have a resource of a babysitter, even if it's even in your own home. So if you had somebody come over and have a game or a art activity with the kids, as long as you have a good hour, 2 hour block to just be really be alone. I know coronavirus has gotten very, very complicated with that, but you have to make that a priority. If you have to get out of the house, if you have to get a motel room or whatever you need to do, but it's very important that the couples have a set aside time alone. You know, if it's every Tuesday at lunch, you know, while the kids are at daycare or school or wherever they are, but it's very important that that is a priority. And it also helps, I think, if you are having a lot of arthritis issues, if you know the time and day. So, you know, mornings may be difficult for people with arthritis because the amount of stiffness that they experience in the morning. And night bedtime is a horrible time to try to have sex because most people who are mothers are just exhausted, especially when you're, you know, you have a chronic illness. So that is probably not the best time to have sex. About 2 o'clock in the afternoon is probably the best time to have sex. So it's really about having something built in where you have some time together as a couple when there's no other have to's that you need to do and the children are out of the house or at least otherwise entertained. Mm. So, you know, whether that's a movie for the children or hopefully a babysitter. Mm.
That kind of dashes are maybe stereotypical expectation that, you know, good sex is spontaneous, it's romantic, it's in the moment. You're kind of saying no, it's kind of a myth that good sex can just happen like that.
Right. Well, it depends on what your definition of sex is. Exactly. So if you're talking about penetrative sex, no, that has to be planned because you have to get the kids out of the house. You have to, you know, the women have to shave their legs because you have to feel pretty. You have to smell good. You know, that we are also worried about all the smells and the feels and everything like that. Sheets clean. I don't know. So, but, you know, if you're talking about my version of sex, which is just intimacy, well, that should happen all the way through the day. I mean, you shouldn't leave the house without kissing your partner. And you should, I love my husband every time he walks by me and grabs my butt. And thank God for that, because that makes me feel desired. So, you know, things like that, that should be an all the way through the day kind of process, intimacy, sending nice little things, you know, chats, texts, tweets, whatever you're going to do with your spouse throughout the day to kind of keep that whole relationship going, not necessarily penetrative intercourse. Mm.
And tell me, is there any research around that looks at the positive effects or the impacts of, say, positive sexual health, positive sexual relations on a person's arthritis or on their pain? What are the benefits of it?
So there was a Rutgers study, which is my favorite one, and it was a small study, but there was a Rutgers study that said that patients' pain threshold went up 110% after an orgasm. The problem was that pain threshold going up 110% wore off after 24 hours. So you kind of have to have an orgasm every day, which is fine. That's okay. Self pleasure, whatever. But you know, there's many, many health benefits. People who just kiss their spouse before they leave work tend to live longer. So if you're just really looking to live longer and have less heart attacks, you should probably kiss your spouse. You're less likely to have, you know, catastrophic things happen to you. It's just, I think people feel better if they have that bonded relationship, if they have trust with another person, if they know that someone has their back.
Mm-hmm. It's extraordinary, isn't it? You mentioned earlier on there about older people and the challenges, you know, around sex and particularly penetrative sex when someone is getting older, you know, the aging of the body. In terms of, but yet we know that sexual health is so important for older people. It's a natural and normal integral part of life. What advice would you have for people who are, you know, more people as the age were likely to have arthritis, whether it is osteo or kind of some of the inflammatory forms? How can they incorporate living with a chronic condition and being sexual beings?
So that goes back to the communication, really. I've had several male patients ask me about Viagra and Cialis and all the medications that help with erectile dysfunction. And the last thing I always say is you have to have a conversation with your spouse or partner before you walk into the room with an erection. Because if your partner is not used to penetrative intercourse because that has not been an option for a while, and you walk into the bedroom with this huge erection, all of a sudden, it's going to hurt your partner physically. And so that really does require communication. But I also think the problem, I know in America, we don't educate people on how to use those medications. It's, you know, there's just a lot of joking around and the men kind of elbowing each other. And of course, I'll give you a prescription for Viagra, but there's not how to use it. You know, it works best on an empty stomach. And nobody knows that. So, you know, they take their partner out to a good meal and drink some alcohol, and then they wonder why it doesn't work. And then they get frustrated and they don't try to have sex anymore, intimacy anymore, because it doesn't work. Well, that's because they had a meal and alcohol. So it's much, much better if you can have sex before you go out to dinner. So it's about educating on how to use the medications, if that's an option for you. There's many other pumps and injectables and things that can be used. But again, for women, there's a lot of atrophy. Sometimes there's a lot of vaginal pain with penetration too. So oral sex is a huge option. There's all kinds of props and pillows and things like that that you can use to raise the hips and to be comfortable. And, you know, it's really just about figuring that out, but investing the time to figure that out. But it's so important to maintain some level of intimacy. And some couples are quite satisfied with just the spooning and the hugging and the kissing, and that's fine as long as they have that kind of relationship. And then, of course, other couples have sex until they die.
And of course, what I'm hearing there is, like, unless you have those conversations between one another as a couple, then you're not going to know, you're not going to be prepared, you're not going to find out what each other enjoy or what works. And so we're back almost, we're back to that starting block, aren't we, the whole time, that it's communication, communication. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, that's so very, very important. I had a young couple, a lady had horrible lupus, just very deforming, scarring, you know, affected her kidneys, horrible lupus. And her husband had been obese and had testosterone deficiency and issues. So he gets the magic pill from his doctor and took his wife on the cruise. And she came back into my office and she was just weeping. She said, you know, he came out of the bathroom to surprise her. He has this huge erection. She felt obligated to have sex with her. There was bleeding. You know, it was very painful for her. You know, that just put another riff in the relationship instead of if they had had the conversation in the get-go. You know, there's pelvic floor physical therapy. You can ready yourself for penetrative intercourse if you have not had that before. I have a patient who's a 65-year-old virgin. She wanted to have sex. Well, we had to prepare her pelvic floor for that. You can't just go from 0 to 90 there.
I'm curious in terms of your thoughts around, okay, so far we've been talking about people largely who are in relationships, but say you're someone who's single and you're starting dating someone, you're going into entering into a new relationship, and this becomes part of, like you were saying earlier, your story, the fact that you're living with this chronic condition, or with a disability, this invisible disability, let's call it. How important is it to bring that up, or when is it appropriate to kind of say, okay, by the way, this is part of who I am, and make people feel safe around disclosing something as personal, as vital as that?
I've got nothing. I have nothing on that one, Brian, because I don't know that there is a right answer. I have talked to numerous individuals about this, and this is incredibly difficult. I wish that I had the right answer for this question, but I just don't. I think some people tell me that they reveal very, very early on, and then other people wait until they feel like the relationship is established and there's a trust basis to reveal, but then they are also hiding a lot of things, which I don't know how honest that is. So it's so difficult because I understand that you have to put yourself out there and you have to try to get, you know, let hurt happen in order to establish a new relationship. And you're trying to establish that connectivity, but there's also the fear of abandonment. And you want people to like you for you. So this is so complicated. I wish that there was just a magic answer to that, but I think it's very, very complicated and it's very, very personal. Mm-hmm.
Do you reckon has the kind of the changing nature of dating, you know, with the apps and all of those kind of things, has that kind of impacted this as well?
I think it's horrifying. I think COVID just made it all much worse too. It's hard to have sex when you have a mask on. You know, I'm kind of standing back and watching to see what happens. I have patients that have tried to date through this, and you know, when you and I were younger, we wanted to know what your HIV status was. Now people want to know whether you've been vaccinated or not. I think it's just, it's a very difficult time to try to develop an intimate relationship with. I think it's great that it's normal to be on a dating app. I think that's people, that is completely normal. I think that's good. So you're putting yourself out there, but are you really putting yourself out there? I mean, are you just going through the motions of putting yourself up on a dating app? But are you really ready for the investment in the relationship? Because like I said, it takes time. You take time to clean your house and you take time to invest in your career, but are you willing to take the time to invest in the relationship?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a changing landscape, all right, isn't it? You mentioned there earlier kind of around sex toys and pillows and supports and resources, let's call them. Do you think, are people surprised at how much material is available to help with all of this and to kind of where they might even begin to find out what type of stuff is available and who should they talk to get that information?
I would not talk to your healthcare provider because they are not going to help you. Probably. You know, the best is in Canada, there was a sex toy shop for individuals with disabilities, specifically quadriplegics and paraplegics and things like that, which I thought was phenomenal. That was Intimacy and Chronic Disease, Marion Kaufman and others. Fran was on that book, but they actually had a whole sex toy shop. I think the availability is great. In the United States, I really like the Pure Romance Company because it's Patty Brisbane and it was at the Kinsey Institute at Indiana University, and I'm a Hoosier, so Indiana's big to me. But they have a lot of things that are available, and most of what they sell is actually body products, more so than the sex toys. You know, they have a really interesting focus on education. So the Pure Romance people are not only toy dealers, but they also really are all trained sex therapists. So that if you find a good Pure Romance person, that they will actually talk to you about intimacy. You can get an online sex coach. You can get an online sex therapist, which is really, really great. But around here, it's not hard to get sex toys at all. And certainly Amazon has them too, which is really great. It's just making sure that you're getting a lubricant that is good and pure, more like you. It's just why Pure Romance Just Like Me is my favorite, because you want something that's not going to hurt you. Certainly those mentholated ones, like in America, we have KY, His and Hers. It's mentholated. And if you have any kind of atrophy or fissures or cracks, sores in your groin, that's going to burn like a son of a gun. So, you know, it's just about making sure that you're getting something that's not going to hurt you.
Really good advice. And I suppose the fact of, you know, people being aware and podcasts like this hopefully will help that, you know, and this was one of the reasons why we wanted to address it. You know, it was discussed as a topic at the EULAR Annual Congress this year. So hopefully, you know, kind of greater awareness around these issues are going to kind of give people, I suppose, a sense of permission that it's, yeah, this is important, that this is something they need to look after and invest really in. Might just kind of turn briefly for a moment to a kind of related topic around, say, pregnancy and parenthood. Let's look at pregnancy specifically, because obviously, you know, for many people who are younger who are diagnosed with inflammatory arthritis, you know, they may be looking to plan a family. How does that kind of family planning impact sexual relationships when you're with a chronic disease?
I think it's very important to talk about your plans for parenting or reproducing with your rheumatologist from the get-go. Because, you know, when you come into the rheumatology staff and you're on fire with your joints and, you know, you have a disease that really could potentially shorten your life expectancy, the biggest concern is putting the fire out and putting you on medications. But it's really the patient's role and responsibility to say, hey, I would like to have a baby next year. I'm trying to have a baby now. I really would like to have babies. Can we talk about medications that are safe? So that's really, really important. And then I made a huge mistake when writing the book, so we'll have probably edition number two. But my whole book, the whole premise is about maintaining intimacy, whatever that is to you, not necessarily penetrative intercourse. And my average age of my patient is 26 years old at my clinic. Just highlighting how these autoimmune things happen in young people, specifically mostly young women. So that really impairs the whole idea of having children and with pain and fatigue and everything like you talked about. So it's really important that that is discussed from the get-go of let's put you on medications that are not going to be a no-no when it comes to having children. And luckily right now there are so many medications that are safe in pregnancy. So that's fabulous. We didn't used to have that. I've been in rheumatology for 22 years and before we just didn't have really good options. And a lot of providers used to tell patients not to get pregnant, which I would never say to anybody. That's your choice. But you can't be scared of the medications. You're scared to seeking help. You got to go get help because there's a ton of medications that you can take and still get pregnant. Mm.
Certainly, it's so much improved, hasn't it, over the last 20-odd years? I mean, it's kind of the landscape is practically unrecognizable now. But yet, at a certain level, we're probably dealing with some of the same challenges around kind of conversation starting. And I'm so glad you mentioned there about having these conversations from the get-go with your rheumatologist. Because oftentimes, you know, I suspect in the rush to deal with the new diagnosis and the meds and get everything under control, pregnancy or parenthood, particularly, you know, at a certain point in your life, may seem a long way off and not at all kind of an immediate concern. But I think unless you start having those conversations, then it's always going to be, you know, it's always that bit further removed from your reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things that I've heard, which I thought was really, really interesting, is that there is a nurse practitioner from California. We tell our patients when they're on methotrexate, you should not get pregnant, because if you get pregnant while you're on methotrexate, your baby can be wildly deformed. So you should not get pregnant. The patient heard you cannot get pregnant. And so to the patient, that meant she couldn't get pregnant. You know, like she didn't need to worry about birth control because on this medication, it was going to be birth control. And so it's really important to clarify what that means. And methotrexate is absolutely a no-no for getting pregnant on. But there are so many other medications that you can get pregnant on. So I think it's really making sure that you ask your healthcare provider, and it's really their responsibility too, to provide you with literature, but also educate you. This medication is an absolute no-no. This one's okay. But just knowing what is okay. But I thought that was really interesting because the lady thought she couldn't get pregnant and we're saying you shouldn't get pregnant.
Yeah. Those age old challenges of communicating. You know, sometimes what's said isn't necessarily what's heard. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I should just point out, by the way, that there's fantastic work happening in an Irish context around pregnancy and arthritis. Some really groundbreaking work, kind of, you know, people like Louise Moore and Doug Veal and Fionnuala McAuliffe, healthcare professionals who are pioneering a lot of work that's taking place. And we've partnered with them and have published material and videos and booklets on our own website. So certainly anyone who's interested in learning more about that, it would be good to visit the Arthritis Ireland website. Iris, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for your time. I might just give your book a mention again. It's called Sex Interrupted. It's available on Amazon. It's a superb read. Really useful, packed I think with loads of practical information and advice into how people can get conversations going, as well as so much more. It's a superb resource for people. And thanks again for your time today. It's been lovely talking to you.
Oh, thank you so much. There's another book that I would highly recommend too, is Mark Gungor has a Laugh Until, I don't know, Laugh Your Way to a Better Marriage. That if people have a religious basis and that is their comfort level, it's hilarious. And he has a bunch of YouTubes too. It's just really about communication and how important intimacy is. So my book is really about how important the conversation is and how important it is to maintain intimacy. But if you want some funny videos, watch Mark Gungor, because he has some really funny videos. He's a pastor in America, and it's just very interesting and educational.
Sounds good. Thanks for that. That's all from this episode of Inflammation Nation. Don't forget you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. For further information about arthritis, you can visit our website, which is arthritisireland.ie, or contact the helpline on 0818 252 846. See you next time. Inflammation Nation is supported by Pfizer.